Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And we have a very special event planned for today. We're going to be giving the Ludwig von Mises Entrepreneurship Award to Mr. Henry Goetz. Entrepreneurship, as you know, is very important to the Austrian school. It's the entrepreneur is central to Mises' understanding of the market, of prosperity, and of liberty. And the Austrian school is really unique among approaches to economic thought in the central role that it gives to the entrepreneur. And part of what we do in our entrepreneurship studies is to recognize the contributions of specific individuals who have made, who have been particularly important as entrepreneurs, helping to move the economy forward, introducing products and services, and helping to spur the kind of prosperity that the Austrian school is all about. Henry Goetz is a longtime friend and supporter of the Mises Institute. You have some information about his company, Morton Buildings, in some brochures in front of you. Mr. Goetz is the founder and longtime president for nearly 40 years of Morton Buildings, located in Illinois, extremely successful company. It's been our pleasure to know him and to interact with him over the years. Mr. Goetz is a member of our Hayek Society, and it's been wonderful having him on the premises today. Mr. Goetz is a great friend of liberty, as well as being a very successful entrepreneur. You can see in your program there one of the quotations that for many years adorned the company newsletters of Morton Buildings. A voluntary exchange for mutual profit is the good relationship among men. And I don't think Ludwig von Mises could have put it any more succinctly. So it's a real pleasure to have Henry Goetz with us today. We've asked him to speak a little bit about his own career, what it means to be an entrepreneur, a little bit about his successes, and to tell us how he was able to thrive and build a great business in an interventionist society where the government was not doing him any favors along the way. So we'd like to know a little bit about what he did, how he did it, how the ideas of liberty and of freedom, and Mises in particular, have been influential to him, and ask him to give us any advice that he would have and what parts we can all play in this great movement going forward. So please join me in welcoming Mr. Henry Goetz.
You've all seen the brochure, seen Morton Buildings, and the type of building we build. Quite a number of buildings we've built various kinds of buildings. And on the backside is a map of the United States, and these little dots back here represent our sales and construction offices. So, this will be about Morton Buildings. No problem hearing me back here, right? Very clear. Okay. Okay, I'm going to start way back in 1890. A farmer in Tremont, Illinois, invented a machine to weave farm fence. And some of his neighbors in the next town saw that he was making money and they wanted to get in on this. And so they hired a man to make a machine for them, and they formed a company, and one of my grandfathers was one of the original people in this company, and they called it Interlocking Fence Company, and they made farm fence, and of course there were no cars then, but they shipped it by a rail freight to farmers in the area. Then in the 1920s, automobiles came in, and many of the farmers bought trucks, and they would bring a load of livestock into the stockyards. And so our people then rented a building at the Peoria stockyards and stocked fence to sell fence, and eventually became a store, and they added other farm items and farm building materials, but basically the stores were there to sell interlocking fence. That was the big thing. But they had farm stores, and they sold many building materials, but did not have any lumber. Now, I started with the company in 1945, and at that time there was pretty much general farming. The farmer would have a dairy barn and beef cattle and a hog house and a chicken house and a corn crib and whatever. And these buildings require lots of maintenance. And in most of the towns, there was a farm carpenter who specialized in helping these farmers keep up their buildings. And you know anything about this? You said you did something of that?
Yes.
Anyway, so I developed a little system that I called on these farm carpenters and got them to tell me what they were going to do and what materials they were going to need. And then I'd go see the farmer. And many times he would buy from me because he knew this farm carpenter was going to get a little commission. And he kind of liked that idea of helping his carpenter out of it. So this worked a little bit. It did a little successful. But this only was good on remodeling or repair jobs because I couldn't sell any lumber. So if he wanted to build a new building, I couldn't quote on it. He'd make a material list on it and he'd take it to the local lumber yard, but I didn't have any lumber, so I couldn't quote on the new barn. So the natural thing to do would be to, why don't we have lumber? Well, a guy named Phil Hutter was our general manager at that time, and he said, this is really a dumb idea. And he said, lumber is too low a margin. It's got to be handled by the local lumber yards who doesn't take any markup. And he had all kinds of reasons why we could not stock lumber. And the reason to top it all off, he said, this had been tried before by Sears Roebuck. And here's a sample of a Sears Roebuck catalog page. Here you could build a whole barn for $950. That would be a hell of a long time ago.
Wow.
But at any rate, it had been tried before and it was never successful. So let's forget the idea. Now, in the 1950s, in the 1950s, the farmers were buying combines. And this combine was a big machine, that would pick corn and sell it in the field. And so the farmers really didn't need fence anymore, but they had a problem with the new combine. It cost a lot of money. And a farmer didn't want to let it sit out and get rusty in the weather. But no, none of his buildings would house the combine because it took a 14-foot high door. So here was a demand for buildings. Now, one of my farm carpenters had a prospect for this type of, this is the type of machine here, building here was a wood laminated rafter and covered with galvanized steel. And so one of my carpenters had a prospect for a building like this, and so I put together a package, and we had most of the materials in Interlocking Fence Company store. We didn't have lumber, but I was had to buy my lumber from the local yard, but I was still able to put the package together if we had a little margin. So this turned out, and I sold another. And pretty soon it looked like a pretty good idea, so other salesmen in an Interlake Defense Company latched onto the idea, and we began selling this building, and sold quite a few of them. In 1951, it sold more. In 1952, the sales doubled, and then they doubled again. And then in 1954, the sales stopped growing. And in fact, we had a bit of a decline. And the reason was the pole building came in. Everybody know what a pole building is? Nobody knows what a pole building is. Anyway, the old agricultural farming service said the farm buildings were built way too much. They were built to last 100 years, and farm methods were changing too fast. And so they recommended a pole building. Now, I'm surprised not too many people know what a pole building is. The pole building was built, pine tree trunks were set in the ground, that was the pole, and you put the lumber on it and cover it with galvanized steel. And it was a real cheap building and a real ugly building, but it did serve the purpose. And many more farmers were doing this because it was too cheap. And so we had a problem. What are we going to do? So decided we'd have to go along with that. So we designed a pole building. But the pole building we designed was better quality than the dome building. And it was higher priced. And we came out with... this was like our first building. The big innovation, we put this red trim around the building. So now we had a little higher price, but we had a status building. And a lot of farmers went for this because it made their farmyard look better. It was a better building than what the better looking building than what the zone people were selling. And then The big change we made was we began selling buildings with painted steel. And boy, this added a lot of cost, but that's what we sold, buildings in color. And we shot way up then after this, because we were the only people that were offering this. So the buildings so good, and we made a lot of money. Now, we still had the farm stores, and the manager of the company was my father and his brothers and his cousins, and they didn't care much for buildings, but they wanted to sell fence. So this was a 1954 catalog at the farm stores. The catalog was all built on fence and fence products, except some farm building materials were in the end of the catalog. But the problem was the fence business was shot. It had gone out. The same thing that made farmer buy buildings made him tear down his fences. But our guys still wanted to sell fence. So we had this catalog, and so on, 1955, 1956. But we were losing money on the fence. The fence business was shot. And the stores were losing money. And the company was going out of business. So the owners wanted to sell. Everybody wanted to sell. So the Interlocking Fence Company was up for sale. But the problem with that was nobody wanted to buy it. With a company going out of business, so there wasn't much of a market. So I was much opposed to selling. So I finally said, I want to buy the business, and I'm going to pay a dollar more than the best offer you've had. And that was okay, but they said, where are you going to get the money? So this was 1960. And then in a couple of years, by negotiation, talking to people in banks and that, we ended up with a package where the old stockholders accepted notes, installment notes for 5 years for 65% of the company. And about 35%. And then the 35%, of the 35%, I ended up with 35%. And my brother and cousins had 65%. So I did not get majority control. So anyway, I was now in control of a company. Yes, I was in control of a company that was going downhill, going out of business, and had a big debt. So what can we do about it? Well, I got all the employees together and made a wonderful speech. And I said, what can we do? I said, are we going to raise prices? And they said, God, you can't do that. Our prices are too high. That's why we're going out of business. And how about reducing salaries? No. I didn't sell that very good. So I said, well, what's left? There's nothing left except we're all just have to get together and work harder and smarter than we've ever done before. That sounded good. But at the end, we went to the end of the year and we made a little profit. But we still had to come up with $100,000 to pay this, you know, this installment note to the other shareholders. And we didn't have the $100,000. And I can't see how this happened. I don't even remember. This was so long ago. But a bank in Chicago gave us $1 million loan. But they charged us 9% interest. We agreed to pay 9% interest on that loan. And, but that gave us a start. And from then on, we sold buildings in color and things just kept going good. Things kept getting better all the time. Now, I do want to mention that I was exceptionally fortunate in having a couple of good men who were in the Interlocking Fence Company organization. And by this time now we changed the name and became Morton Buildings. And one of them was Ken Weaver as a company. And man, he was good. He seemed to have the answer to every financial problem, so we could just work ourselves one out. But the real gem was a guy by the name of Bill Uphoff. And he was a seedy looking guy. I could never get him to put on a white shirt and a tie. But he worked for our store in, he was a manager of one of the Interlocking retail stores. So I got him to come to Morton as the sales manager. And he really ended up more like a general manager. And he's the guy that set up a bunch of incentive programs. In other words, he set up a program where there were so many hours allowed to build a building. And if the crew built a building in the hours allowed, they earned a big bonus. And if they built a building in less than the hours allowed, they got an even bigger bonus. But if they didn't build a building in the hours allowed, then they were in trouble. And we had a problem too. And the same way he had incentive programs for the, well, you might say everybody, the designers and plants and the salesmen, everybody was on bonus or incentives of some kind. And a lot of the systems he set up were so good that basically we are using the same systems 40 years from now. Am I right on that, Rudy? Yeah, okay. Rudy always agrees with me, right?
The reason I agree with you is that you still use it today.
Okay. So, and they set up this program of offices. We built a building and had a sales and a construction office. And the idea was to have a building for the crew. We set the buildings 100 miles apart. And the crew could go out and get home at night. We didn't have to stay out. And then we got some buildings over here. We built a building over there, and we kept building buildings. So we got almost halfway across the country. Wow. Just not by plants, but by, we just followed the demand, you might say. So we just ended up in, every year seemed to be breaking records, new records. And I guess we sold a total, I don't know, 350,000 buildings, something like that. We're building 5,000 to 10,000 buildings a year. And for one thing, let's see, I got something here. Oh. Yeah, here's a page of one of our letters. Let's see, this was the year 201. We earned a $27 million profit. Now, what are you going to do with $27 million profits? That was before taxes and profit sharing. But here, we paid $5 million to the employees as profit sharing. Then we had an extra $3 million, which we invited among the employees, simply because we made so much money, and we wanted the employees to have more of it. And then we paid at $8 million in dividends, which went mostly to the shareholders. And we paid $8 million in income taxes. I think I got most of it, but anyway, when it was all done, we still had a couple million dollars left to reinvest in the company. And this just went on year after year. Now, how could this have happened? Well, I'd like to give part of it to the Rockwell. And we tried to teach free market economics to all the employees. And let's see, what do I got here? Here's one of our pages from one of our employees' letters. Put the slogan on all of it as we could. From Ayn Rand, a voluntary exchange for mutual profit is the only good relationship among men. Try to get everybody to believe this, that you work hard and you get rewarded for it. And I also wrote a lot of editorials, and my editorials were all free market. This was against Social Security, and this was against unions and so forth. And we had meetings and lectures and so forth. And I like to think this is a big help in making employees more productive. Then one thing we did was a little unusual. We promoted only from within. Everybody in the company started at an entry-level position. So everybody was experienced by the time they got their job. And but the big thing we had for incentives was incentives. As I mentioned, we had profit sharing, we had special bonuses, we had And Aesop, whatever Aesop is, anyway, all the employees owned stock in the company, so they all got dividends. And then we had individual bonus, everybody had drawn individual incentives. And one of the big incentives, we had incentive trips. And almost everybody was, what? Had a chance to qualify for these trips. God, we had Caribbean cruises in Hawaii, and we took people to China and Hong Kong and Athens, Greece, and so on. And this was a big modifier for production. So, I have 7 on my program. Incentive programs are great. Yes, the incentives go to the right people. And that's the problem. For the incentives to be awarded, you have to set up whatever. What do you call them? What do you call them? You set up really
checkup system.
Programs and procedures and all that kind of stuff. And then you have to have a way of measuring the performance. And man, that is tough. And the only way I know is you've got to have a good man who can handle this. And we did have a good man. And he's the guy right there, Rudy. He handled this. And you take a building, and there are many people involved in making a building. You got the crew people, the salesman, the truck driver, the plant, the guy that loaded the baggage, all kinds of people. And when everything goes smooth, everybody gets a nice bonus. And the company makes good money. But people do make mistakes. And when sometimes the mistakes are bad, and sometimes the mistakes are so bad that the whole building goes sour. And instead of making a profit, the company loses money. Now what happens to the incentives? Now the key is finding who made the mistakes. Now when everything goes good, everybody's happy, says, boy, I did a great job. Well, when things go bad, it's a different story. It wasn't my fault. See, it was somebody else's fault. Now it's Rudy's job. Rudy's job is not to pay incentives. He's got to find somebody's going to be Nick. And he's got to find that guy. And he has got a jury or trial and witnesses. He's got to make the decision on the basis of knowledge he can gain quickly. And by doing this, Rudy's going to take away the incentive bonus from that guy, and that guy didn't think he was guilty. So Rudy ends up with a hell of a lot of enemies.
I'm not sitting here, Rudy.
But she's going to go with the way of doing it. The fact that he did a wonderful job was that it went up that way. And it just said it was a terrific, terrific job. So, in our company, like in other companies, there's politics, there's lots of it. As I mentioned earlier, I never did have majority control of the company. I was the biggest stockholder, but I never had majority control. I've got to give my brother and his brother some credit. They let me run the company for 41 years. And then I got to be 82 years old. And that was 11 years ago, so you know how old I am now. And they walk in one day and said you're fired. And that, as I say, that was a long time ago. But the company is still going. They hired a new president. And he had very little bit of experience in our type of buildings. And the profit went down. And he brought in a bunch of guys from his old team. And that didn't help any. He went down even further. And then he got rid of that president and got a different president and so on. So the company is still in business. And still making some beautiful buildings. But the profits have gone way, way down. And when we were going this way, now it's going this way. And this day we were building, expanding, and hiring people. And last year we laid off people and closed 10 offices. Thank you.
Well, Henry, thank you very much for that wonderful talk. Periodically, we present the Mises Entrepreneurship Medal to somebody who represents not only a great entrepreneurship in his own person, but also supports the ideas of freedom that make the entrepreneur's work possible. Mm-hmm. We'll give you that medal. And I'm going to read the certificate. Ludwig von Mises Institute proudly presents to Mr. Henry Guess the Mises Entrepreneurship Medal in grateful recognition of his dedication to learning, prosperity, and freedom, presented at Auburn, Alabama, of course, not today. So, Henry, thanks a million. Taking any questions?
Yeah, we are.
Anybody have questions?
Mr. Getz, were your other offices franchises? Could people buy into those?
Awfully hard hearing.
Were your other offices franchises? Did people buy into them?
No, we own all of them.
Why don't you stand up there and repeat the question?
Yeah.
Okay. Stand up or sit next to him and repeat the question.
Yeah.
Want me to do it?
Yeah.
Let me do it.
Well, you're asking whether all these franchises were all... No, we own all. These are all the stores our company owns.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Peter. Henry, it sounds like the company has always been fairly generous with its employees in terms of providing bonuses for work that's well done, employee stock options, and so forth. We often hear critics of capitalism describe a fundamental antagonism between management and employees, or between owners and employees. In your case, it sounds like treating employees well was very good for the profitability of the company.
There's no antagonism at all.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, we all want the same thing. We want to earn income. We want to have profits. And we want to keep money in the company so we can expand. And as we expand, everybody gets voted within. So what better way to get a better job? Make the company expand. Do your job. No problem. Yeah.
No HR department.
But yeah.
No HR department.
Oh, great.
Mr. Getz, are you still involved in other business projects and ventures? Or?
No. Well, more or less. Yeah, I own a little farmland and have a few rental real estate property. But basically, this is the only business for me.
Mr. Getz, was there ever any temptation to move out of your core business? Because many businesses lose money when they do that. I mean, at any point did you contemplate moving out of it into something else?
No, we were expanding so fast that we could. Right. This Billy Joe Upoff, I mentioned. You want to do this.
Right.
We have enough money to do this. But we were getting 10% down. with Billy Horton. He said, well, we're going to get 30% down. We're going to get the customer to give us more money so we can expand faster.
What about debt? I mean, did you take a position on getting into debt much? Or
just the first time.
Just the first, and then after that,
it was
all
right.
Just financed by returned earnings and profit.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Mr. Getz, I know you said that the current president had to close offices and lay off employees. Did that ever have to happen during your tenure?
Oh, not under my rule. It never happened.
I didn't think so.
We were just expanding all the time.
Boy, did you have a question?
Yeah. Henry, if you were going to build your business today in 2013, what would be any different difficulties you might come across to be successful?
Yeah. Well, things should be harder either. There's more root. I can't even speak to you anymore. I'm tongue-tied. There's more regulations today than there were 4 years ago. No question.
What would be some of the most important regulations in your business that would be more complex and onerous today than they were when you were starting?
EPA.
Environmental.
OSHA.
Yeah.
How, when you were building, Mr. Getz, how did you compensate for the various building codes in the different localities?
What's that again?
I said, how did you have a standard system for accommodating the different building codes in different states and localities?
Not really. Of course, our biggest building was farm building, and we didn't worry about codes or anything like that. But if you went into an area that didn't have a code, you have to accommodate that code, whatever it is.
Mr. Getz, I remember you saying that there was an editorial that you wrote about unions.
Well, what?
Unions?
Yeah.
Did that convince your workers to not unionize? Did they ever consider that?
Well, I hope. That was part of writing this story.
Yes. No union.
Did other workers in other companies in the same industry, did they try to unionize in other companies?
Not really. This whole building industry was pretty much a farm building thing. And it was not very much unionized. Okay.
As an entrepreneur, how far ahead did you look in your planning for your business? You know, when you made investments and so on. 2 years or less or more?
More like 2 weeks.
So things were changing very rapidly?
The market was... We were just following the market. I mean, if people are sure demand our building, we'd have to build an office over here. And really, they were doing long range plans. It sounds ridiculous, but that's the way it was.
Any other questions? Alex?
You were president through a lot of economic ups and downs throughout your career. And I wonder, did you have any philosophy about dealing with business cycles, or did you watch your company in the recent financial crisis do things that you would have done differently, or anything along those lines?
So there are business cycles, recessions, and boom periods when you were running your company.
Yeah.
What, did you do anything special to adjust to those cycles?
Well, of course, the big change was in the 1970s. A lot of inflation. Mm-hmm. Farm values are going up 10-50% a year regularly. Then when Reagan got in, was in 1980, and they stopped the inflation.
Right.
And the farmlanders farm income went down as fast as they'd gone up. But fortunately, they started a big, I guess it was a big arm of the program out east, and they just had a big demand for buildings out there. And we were able to make some offices out there, and we could tell our people, we have a job for you out east at the sales up in the east, and if the
We didn't have to really lay any bit.
Wow.
Essentially all. So we've been fortunate that we were able to flow in a cycle.
Right. Okay, thank you.